different degrees of knowledge of a quantum state, and how one can transform among them. But I'm going to broaden it out a little bit and talk about several other related subjects. And most of this isn't new research. What new research there is in here is largely due to these collaborators of mine. But a lot of it is just summarizing some things that have been known for a long time, and I think there are interesting connections among them. So I'm going to begin with some metaphoric and historical remarks about quantum information. In fact, quantum information, I always tell people, is a beautification of an enlargement of classical information theory in the same way that the complex numbers are a completion and improvement of the theory of real numbers. But often I have to explain quantum information to people who have no mathematical background and are inexplicably uninterested in acquiring one. So I have to come up with other metaphors for the difference between quantum and classical information. So what I usually say, and is this visible in the back?
No.
It is not.
Maybe we need lower light.
Yes, can we make the light in the auditorium less? Because it's barely visible from here. Is that better? You're not supposed to read the stuff on the tablet. I mean, that's. For these people, at the cost of overstimulating the new world element among us, still among us, new age, I mean, not new world. I say that the quantum information is like information in a dream, and that when you remember a dream too many times, you don't really remember the dream, you just remember what you said about it. But we don't need to even think about those things here, because we understand it from a mathematical standpoint, even if some of us don't believe in it. But there is a question that I've wondered about, why the theory of information was not developed on quantum foundations even from the very beginning, because the essential discoveries of quantum mechanics were in the early 20th century, before the work of Turing and Shannon, and indeed some of them were done by some of the same people, like von Neumann, who later developed computers. And I think my idea about the answer to this was that people in the early 20th century thought of computers and of information processing as a macroscopic activity. And they therefore, and they thought of quantum mechanics as microscopic, and they couldn't bridge this distance. So that has always seemed to me a pretty inadequate explanation. In view of the fact that even some 19th century thinkers thought clearly about information in microscopic terms. However, I was discussing this with Nicolas Jussin in Geneva, and he had, I think, a better idea as to why the development of quantum information theory is progressing now instead of something that happened in the 30s and 40s and 50s. And this is because in trying to understand quantum mechanics and the significance of it, many people, and especially engineers, thought of it as a... Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. It looks like you just made it. engineers thought of quantum effects as a... How do I get rid of this light here? Oh, yes. As a nuisance, something that would cause a quantum device to perform unreliably and otherwise do what a classical device would do. So they concentrated too much on the uncertainty principle and not enough on entanglement. And that, and therefore the appreciation that there was a positive aspect of quantum information grew out of, first of all, exploiting its negative aspect, as Gilles Rassard explained, and then realizing finally that because of entanglement, chiefly because of entanglement, there were positive aspects. And now I'm actually joking about quantum government. I don't think I've seen any papers on that subject yet. Would that be a positive development? I think it depends on how... Well, I kind of think of it as a positive development because I would like to imagine in some sense that my perception of the outcome of the last U.S. election is not entirely real. So I'm going to speak about quantum information processing, and as other speakers have emphasized, the subject gets interesting and complicated, especially, maybe not only, but especially when you think of processing of a multipartite system. That is, everything isn't all in the same laboratory, so you're able to do any unitary operation on it. If you were, you could pretty much transform any quantum state into any other state. But if the parts are separated, and if you have to use limited resources, for example, classical communication, which I represent by these thick arrows, or a noisy channel for sending some quantum information from Alice to Bob, or perhaps an interaction, a weak interaction between these two parties that are nominally separated, or some shared entanglement, or even thinking in a negative way, the ability to perform irreversible operations that generate heat. These are all quantifiable resources, and you can ask what transformations of quantum information or quantum state are possible, and what is the cost of doing this transformation in terms of these resources. Well, of course, we know without any limitation on the resources, the transformations that are possible, and I think if it was not already described by Michael Nielsen, Peter Shor will say some more about it, that is mathematically the transformation of the initial state to the final state is a completely positive trace-preserving map. But if it has to happen in a multipartite system, there are various requirements and trade-offs among these resources, and this has turned into a rich field of research. So whenever you have resources and transformations, you can have equivalent states or properly reducible states or incomparable states, and you can make hierarchies of reduction based on those. And then there's something that is sort of in between equivalence of two resources and incomparability, and that is where you can transform one into another, but not efficiently. You can produce either one from the other, but in doing so, there is some loss. And the example that my colleague John Smolin always cites for this is that it is in fact possible to, contrary to the proverb, to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. But it actually takes a lot of sow's ears to make one silk purse, because mulberry, silkworms don't actually eat sow's ears. They refuse to eat them. And the only way you can make a silk purse out of a sow's ear is to fertilize the mulberry tree with the sow's ears, then let the silkworms eat the mulberry leaves, make the silk purse. So this is a very big loss. And then, of course, the silk purse, you can feed it to pigs, and I think the pigs will actually eat silk purses and be able to digest them. So anyway, here's some examples of that kind of resource. If we have a tripartite entangled state, a Greenberg or Horn-Seilinger state here, and we want to convert it into bipartite entangled states, like a Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen-Bohm state, we can take one of these tripartite states and convert it into a bipartite entangled state. But we can't go back again. However, if we have two bipartite entangled states, we can combine them to produce one tripartite state. So every time around, there's a loss, just as in going between silk purses and sow's ears. So we have in this theory of resources some simple scalar resources in which you can just use a single number to quantify the resource, and every state has a certain amount of it. And that is an example of that is in the theory of entanglement of pure bipartite states, the asymptotic theory. They can be characterized by a single number. And similarly, the asymptotic ability in classical information for channels to simulate one another is completely parameterized just by a single number, which is the Shannon capacity of the channel. But in the more usual situation, we have this silk purse and sow's ear situation, or even totally incomparable resources of which you cannot make one by even an infinite supply of another. Resources that cannot be substituted at all. And this kind of situation occurs with bipartite mixed state and multipartite pure states, as I just showed you. It happens with the different kinds of capacities of quantum channel, which I'll say a little bit about, and Peter Shor will say a lot more about later this afternoon. And then I'm going to speak about two other things. One is, and that was my main topic of my for today, which was the transformations, the irreversible transformations and reversible ones among different degrees of knowledge of a quantum state. So, for example, if I have a classical description of the quantum state, that's the most powerful, and I can convert that into a single specimen of the state, but I can't go backward. So I'll say a lot more about that. And then we can also ask about, and I'll say a little bit about this, the ability of one interaction Hamiltonian to simulate another. Well, this is pretty much what I already said, that bipartite pure states are characterized by asymptotically by a single number, their entanglement. Because you can efficiently convert states with equal entanglement into one another with a loss and an amount of classical communication that grows more slowly than the number of states that you convert. This paper by Lowe is the one that showed that the amount of classical communication, which we had neglected when we first wrote about this, this is Bernstein and Popescu and Schumacher, that this this classical communication is something that is not needed except in a small amount, a negligible amount, ultimately. Well, now another thing which Peter will talk about a lot more, but I'll introduce, is the fact that quantum channels are unlike classical channels in that they have several different capacities that are not monotonically related to one another, or not proportional to one another. And the capacities depend on what you're trying to use the channel for, and what auxiliary resources you bring into play. The most straightforward capacities are the capacity for the channel for transmitting qubits reliably, and in order to do that, you use the channel in connection with a quantum error correcting code. And then there's the ordinary classical capacity, which is just to say you're using the quantum channel and you're trying to send the most classical information through it. And then there are these two assisted capacities. This is the quantum capacity in which you allow some back communication from the receiver to the sender. And if you do, you can use quantum channels to share entanglement. This is quantum capacity in the presence of two-way classical communication. And this can be greater than the ordinary quantum capacity because of the ability to share entanglement through the quantum channel and then distill it and then teleport using it. So some channels that have no straightforward quantum capacity can still be used to share, to transmit quantum states. And then this last one, which Peter will say a lot about, is the classical capacity of a channel when you allow an unlimited supply of entanglement to help it send classical information. Of course, entanglement by itself cannot send classical information, but it can boost the capacity of channels to do so. And these capacities can be defined in a way that is comparable to the definition of classical capacity in ordinary information theory. The general setup is that you have, in order to get the full capacity, the asymptotic capacity, you need to use a block code of several inputs. So we take several inputs, and this means in the quantum situation an arbitrary state in the tensor power of the Hilbert space of the input. So this will be m qubits. You allow a quantum encoder, you send the output of the encoder through several instances of the channel, and then we have a quantum decoder which produces some quantum state coming out, which in general is a mixed state. And the quantum capacity is just the maximum number of qubits per channel use that you can send in the limit of large block size and low error. So this is just, you can read that yourself. All right. For every error amount epsilon, you want infinitely many combinations of m and n, that is the block sizes, with the m over n ratio at least as great as r. That's the rate that we're trying to send through the channel. And it should also be true that for this combination of m and n, for any input state, the fidelity of the output relative to the input is greater than 1 minus epsilon. So we don't demand average case good performance, we demand best case good performance, just as with a classical channel. It's supposed to transmit every state, every input with less than the epsilon error probability. And you can take the same expression and only change it to give the classical capacity by saying the thing doesn't have to work for all inputs, but only inputs that are basis states. And then this becomes the classical capacity of a quantum channel when we have the full power of a quantum encoder and a quantum decoder to help us send classical information through the channel. And it's not, in some instances, that does help. At least the quantum decoder helps. We don't know whether the quantum encoder helps. Well, the general picture I had of quantum channel capacities, the qualitative picture, until yesterday, was that I guess as Tolstoy said that all noiseless channels are the same, but every noisy channel is different. So if we start off from our ideal noiseless channel in the middle, we can go off in various directions for different kinds of noise. But in whichever direction we go off, the properties of the noiseless channel are gradually lost one after another, or perhaps several properties are lost at once, but they're lost in a certain order. And so the first thing that happens as you go out is the channel loses its ability to send quantum information without some kind of assistance of a classical communication. And so we drop off from the bright green area to the light green area. here the channel can be used for quantum communication, but you need classical assistance. And then we go out further, it gets noisier, and we get this blue area where the channel cannot be used for quantum communication anymore, but it still is somewhat quantum in that its capacity for classical communication is improved by supplying entanglement beforehand between the sender and the receiver. And then finally we get out to these totally classical channels which have no quantum properties at all. So these blue channels here are channels that you could classically simulate by making a measurement of the sending end and sending information to the receiving end without any quantum link between sender and receiver. But even some of those channels will have their capacity boosted by sharing prior entanglement. And Peter will tell you all about that. However, just yesterday, Peter came up with a counterexample to my belief that this describes the situation. So what's the situation as we know isn't like this now. And so what happens is that you can invent a channel in which the classical capacity is not improved by supplying entanglement, but it still has a quantum capacity. So we call it a crypto-quantum channel because its quantum abilities are hidden, and if you don't send in the right kind of input, you don't even realize it has a quantum capacity. So an example of this kind of channel would be one that takes in 3 qubits and puts out 2. And what it does is when it receives the first qubit, it measures it in the up-down basis. And if it's up, it throws away the third qubit or randomizes the third qubit. And it doesn't throw it away, it randomizes it and transmits the second one faithfully as the quantum channel. So you can use this channel to send 1 qubit if you want by using the first qubit to say the second qubit should be transmitted faithfully as a qubit, even at the cost of randomizing the third one. But then if the first qubit is down, the channel does something else to its other two inputs. It transmits them faithfully as classical information but completely dephases them, so it has no quantum capacity. If you work out the formulas, this channel, its classical capacity is so much greater than its quantum capacity that if you're trying to use it for classical communication, you don't even ever use the quantum part of it, and therefore its entanglement-assisted capacity is not any greater than its unassisted capacity. So there are more pathologies yet to be discovered. But now I want to go on to my main topic, which is thinking about not channels or states in themselves, but degrees of knowledge about a quantum state. And so here are some different ways in which you might be said to know about a quantum state. You could have a classical description of it, which is the best thing. Or you could have a specimen of the state, that is a physical system in the state. Or if you live in Florida, you could have a ballot that might have been punched in favor of the state. And you would like to know the transformations amongst these various degrees of knowledge of the same thing. So for example, in teleportation, we transform a single specimen in the sender's laboratory to a single specimen in the receiver's laboratory. So this is a transformation involving the same level of knowledge about the quantum state. In something that I'm going to talk about some more today, remote state preparation, which is originally proposed by Popescu and discussed by Lowe, and we've written a paper on it since then. You start off, it's like teleportation. We have shared entanglement and we're allowed forward classical communication, but we have a stronger resource in the sender's end. We have a complete classical description of the state. but we're only trying to produce a single specimen of the state for the receiver. So this is a stronger resource at the sender's end, and it should make this job easier, and that's what I'll say. And then there have been some other there are some other transformations that are in this same category. Here we start off with a classical description of the state. It's called remote measurement. It's discussed by or introduced by Patti, in which you start off with a description of the state, and you're not trying to produce a copy of the state. You're only trying to simulate the ability to perform a single measurement on the state. And you can also try go between these same resources in and out, but try to do it without any entanglement, just substituting classical information. And this is called classical teleportation. Actually, I took this slide from a place where Gilles Brassard had also spoken on that subject. He didn't say anything about it at this conference, so don't be misled by that. Well, I tried to find a common language for describing all these degrees of knowledge of a quantum state. And the term that I came up with, or the idea I came up with, is I call a mystification of the quantum state. So what a mystification is something which, if you had it, you would be able to predict the results of a measurement on the state more accurately than you could do if you had no information about the state at all. Now, operationally, a mystification can be thought of as, well, I should call it a black box, only I'm going to show you what's inside. It's a box which has various inputs and outputs, and inside it has a classical description of the state. But the classical description isn't completely accessible because it's locked inside the box. So here is an examples of mystifications. The complete classical description being entirely available is what a mathematician would call it, the null mystification. And then we can get from that two specimens of the state, or one, or as we'll see, one state antipodal to the original state on the Bloch sphere. And this is the one that I show up here, the illustration of. This is a black box which allows you to simulate a measurement on the state. And the way you can implement that is that inside the black box you have a specimen of the state, and you have an input port for classical information and an output port. The input port describes the measurement. Inside the box, you do the measurement, and you send the result out through the output port. And the box is set up so that if you try to use it again, it doesn't work at all. So it's a box that will simulate one measurement. So now, let's look at some of the relations among these mystifications. But I think before that, I want to speak about the reason that having a specimen of the state is not the same as being able to simulate a measurement on it. Of course, if I have a knowledge of a qubit state, I can prepare it, or I could prepare the opposite state, the state orthogonal to it. But if I were given a single specimen of the state, I cannot convert a specimen of this state, if I don't know what it is, into a specimen of the opposite state, because this inversion in the Bloch sphere is an anti-unitary transformation. There's no unitary operation that will convert one of those to another. And this was exploited by Dessin and Popescu to show that a pair of anti-parallel spins conveys more information about the spin direction than a pair of parallel spins, which would not make any sense classically. Now, here is why having a specimen of the antipodal state allows you to simulate a measurement on the original state, even though it can't allow you to make the original state. The reason is in order to simulate a measurement on the antipodal state, maybe I'm getting a little tired of this heavy stick. I'm going to try the little hand here, the weightless hand. Can you see this little weightless hand here as well as the stick? All right. So in order to simulate the measurement on the original state, which you don't have, you do the antipodal measurement, the upside-down measurement on the upside-down state. So if we think in physical terms of Stern-Gerlach apparatus, we're trying to find out what would happen if you send this spin into this apparatus, this measuring apparatus. We don't have this spin, but instead we build the upside-down measurement apparatus. And if you look carefully, you can see this apparatus is inverted through the origin. So it's just a mirror image measuring apparatus. And we send the system through here, and we get an outcome, a distribution of measurement outcomes that's the same as the distribution here. And this means that giving a measurement apparatus, a macroscopic measurement apparatus, you can always construct the inverted measuring apparatus, even though you can't invert the states. Oh, a real laser pointer. Oh, thanks. And this holds true in larger dimensional Hilbert spaces as well. But now we want to say that the ability to simulate a measurement, we know it can't be converted into a specimen of the state, but there's some other ways in which it's less valuable form of information than having a state. Suppose we have a state. Now, if I have a state, then I can do not only measurement on the state, but I could measure jointly on that state and some other unknown state, phi, which somebody gives me. But if I have psi antipode, I can't do that because I don't know how to invert this other state. Or suppose I have one of these states or the other and I know which one, then I can simulate any measurement because I know whether to build the right side up or upside down measuring apparatus. But I can't communicate this to a third party without sending them a qubit and a bit. The qubit is the state, and the bit is whether it's right side up or not. So it's a more difficult to communicate form of knowledge of the quantum state than having a single specimen of the state. Of course, if we have one of these black boxes, it's very cumbersome to transmit from one person to another. So this is some of the hierarchy of reductions among these different forms of knowledge. These three are up at the top, and they are equivalent, having a classical description of the state, having infinitely many of them, and being able to simulate any number of von Neumann measurements on the state. All of those things are equivalent because you can convert them into one another with arbitrary accuracy. And then as we go down the hierarchy, we get to having two specimens of the state, which will enable us to simulate two measurements. Or we can throw one of the specimens away, we get one specimen of the state. And here are two incomparable resources. Having one specimen doesn't allow us to do two measurements, and being able to do two measurements doesn't allow us to create one specimen. And then finally, down at the bottom, well, you can make them very weak, you could have unreliable measurements. But if you have one von Neumann, the abilities to simulate a von Neumann measurement on this state, it doesn't allow us to simulate a generalized measurement. Well, the only real science that we've added to this hierarchy is something that grew out of a lunchtime discussion at IBM with very many people, all three Horodetskys and the whole IBM group and Peter Shor were all there, and we were saying, well, everybody knows that if we have one specimen of the unknown state, we can simulate a joint measurement on this state and some other state of which we're given as another quantum input. But how about going in the reverse? To be able to simulate a joint measurement, is that enough in order to produce one specimen of the state? And I blushed that that I made this argument, and I said, "Oh, this can't be, because when I simulate a joint measurement on a state, it's a black box with two quantum inputs, but only a classical output, and we're trying to get a quantum state out, so we can't get a quantum state out because there's no quantum output. It just has classical output. And then I forget who it was. I think it might have been Debbie Lung said, "Well, why don't you try to teleport?" And I said, "Oh yes, teleporter. We should all say teleporter. Worked on it for a little while." And so it really, in retrospect, is quite obvious. Here is what I mean by the ability to simulate a joint measurement on psi in another state. We have a black box that has psi in it. We have another state that comes in as an input. We have a description of the measurement, and what comes out is the output of the measurement. So the obvious thing to do in retrospect is to feed it half of a Bell pair, of an entangled pair, ask it to do a Bell measurement, and then take the classical output of the Bell measurement and do the corrective Pauli operation on the other half of the EPR pair. So we essentially, we just teleport this trapped state inside out of its prison, and we get it out in a quantum form. So that completes that reduction. We have an equivalence here between one specimen of the state and the ability to simulate a joint measurement. And now we can generalize this idea. Other people have generalized this idea to talk about not knowledge of a state, but ability to perform unitary operations. And so if I have a classical knowledge of a unitary operation, then I can do it as many times as I want, and I can do it, I can build it into a larger circuit. I can perform a controlled U as well as a U. So this is represented in this diagram. I say classical knowledge of U will allow me to make a black box for U, or it'll allow me to make a black box for controlled U. But I don't know whether this, there are probably some people here who know the answer to this. Maybe Mike knows the answer to this. You've worked on this. Maybe you've worked on this. Anyway, that is whether it's proven or merely suspected that you cannot convert a black box for U into a black box for controlled U. Of course, you can go the other way, just feed it to zero. But now what is known is that if you take a black box for a unitary operation U, and you have some additional resource, which is an eigenvector of U and a knowledge of its eigenvalue, then we can convert this black box U into a black box controlled U and get back these two resources that we use. So it's a kind of catalysis in which without the eigenvector we can't do it, but with the eigenvector we can. And the way to do that is this kind of circuit, these are the two inputs to the control U, and essentially we use the control input to swap whether the other input gets sent through. This is a swap gate, controlled swap. Whether the other input gets sent through U or gets shunted aside and just sent through a straight wire. But in order to make it come out right and put the control wire back into its original state and be unentangled, we have to have this eigenvector, and we have to do this eigenvalue correction. So that just shows that there's a lot more research to be done in understanding the properties of transformations among ability to different degrees of knowledge, which classically would be equivalent, but in the quantum world are not equivalent because you cannot convert them all one into another. Now, here's another example of this. Suppose Alice has two copies of an unknown state and wants to send Bob only one copy. So does having the extra copy enable her to do this with less quantum communication than ordinary teleportation or just ordinary sending it through a quantum channel? So in other words, can she do it with less than one bit of quantum communication? And the answer is yes. Essentially, she measures one of the states in order to find out something about what its direction is. And with that knowledge of its, partial knowledge of its direction, she can compress the other state. Of course, she needs to do it on large blocks. She needs to compress it because its posterior entropy, given the result of that measurement, is less than 1 bit. So similarly, if there's no quantum channel and Alice has 2 copies of the state, she can teleport one of them using less entanglement than in standard teleportation, but more classical communication. And something we don't know the answer to is, can she teleport 1 copy to Bob with less classical communication than if she only had 1 copy to start with? She starts with 2 copies. Does this copy also enable her to use less classical communication to communicate it? So this is, in fact, I've been getting into this subject from what I just said, the question of remote state preparation and the resources required to produce a quantum state. In the receiver's lab, when the sender has a complete knowledge of the quantum state. So as you see, of an ordinary teleportation, the sender has a single specimen, and there's shared entanglement, and the receiver gets a single specimen. And it's very clean and simple. It works perfectly well for a single instance of the state. There's no trade-off between entanglement and classical communication. If you have less than 2 bits of classical communication, you can't make up for it by using more entanglement. And you can use these same resources to teleport not a pure state, but something that's entangled with another system. And if you have backward communication from Bob to Alice, it doesn't help. So this is all very simple. But now we go into this regime where we have classical knowledge of the state on the sender's part. And it turns out everything becomes more complicated and also more efficient in the sense that in order to get the most efficient transmission, we have to go to block codes and send several states at once. These states are not copies of the same state. They're arbitrary different states, but we process them in a batch mode. We have shared entanglement. We have classical communication. It turns out that backwards classical communication can help, and the way it can help is that it allows us to recover some of the entanglement that we use so that we can do it with less entanglement. And finally, we get out these specimens, single specimens of each of the classically described states here. And this exhibits a non-trivial trade-off between entanglement and classical communication. So if we have more entanglement, we can use less classical communication. And it allows, as I said, the backward communication helps. And it also works for sending parts of entangled states known by the sender. So imagine this psi 1 is a bipartite system of 2 qubits, and she only wants to send one to Bob and keep the other herself. This remote state preparation works for that, but it is for entangled states, it's cheaper than sending pure states. In fact, what the trade-off looks like, as best as we know, in teleportation, if we ask how many bits are needed to send 1 qubit and how many e-bits, EPR pairs worth of entanglement, we have this rectangular profile here, which means that this is the feasible zone. If we have more than 2 or more bits of classical communication and 1 or more e-bits of entanglement, we can do it. Otherwise, we can't do it. But when we go to remote state preparation, we get a curve that looks like this. At least this is an upper bound. It might be more efficient than this. That is, if we have the best way we know how to do it for 2 bits is just teleportation. But if we allow more bits, we can send it with less entanglement using more classical communication. And if we allow more entanglement, we can send it for less classical communication, eventually approaching only 1 bit of classical communication in the limit of not even a large amount of entanglement, but about 3.8 bits of entanglement. And recently, Devitok and Berger at Cornell have come out with an improvement on this low entanglement protocol, considerable improvement, which is optimal under some other assumptions. That is, as lower as well as an upper bound. One cannot say that it is... that one is sure that it's optimal unless you believe this point here teleportation is also optimal. If this is optimal, then this whole curve is optimal. Now, how does this... I'm going to only talk about how we can send, remotely prepare a state for less than 2 bits of classical communication if we have a lot of entanglement. So I'm going to talk about this part of the curve. And here's how we do it. It's similar to what I said about the problem of transforming a state into its antipode. So suppose we start off with a singlet state shared between Alice and Bob. In fact, they share they can share an arbitrarily large number of these things as their unlimited resource. And now we want to transmit the known state psi. Well, since we know it, we can measure a singlet or half of a singlet along that direction. And when we do that, the outcome of the measurement, this is a von Neumann measurement, is equally likely to be psi or psi antipode, of course. And the other one, the other unmeasured qubit, which is in Bob's laboratory, is left in the other state. So if we get psi, Bob gets psi antipode. If we get psi antipode, Bob gets psi. So this is an attempt to prepare the state remotely in Bob's lab that succeeds with probability 1/2. And so we're trying to send this state, and we try to do it, and sometimes it succeeds, and sometimes it fails. And when it fails, it gives the antipode. So of course, if we could convert the antipode into the forward state, this would be a way of remote preparing with 1 bit of classical communication, because we just tell Bob whether to invert the state or not. But of course, Bob can't invert a general unknown state, so this is not a way of doing it yet. But in order to make it work, we go into an asymptotic regime in which we try to send several different states, arbitrary different states, and we try to send each one of them. We try many times to send it. There's no problem doing that because we know classically what it is. So we have a lot of shared singlets with the Bob, and I try to send it using the first singlet, and I try to send it using the second and the third and the fourth, and I keep doing it, sending it a lot of times, and I write a table in which I have a 1 in the table every time I succeed, that is, succeed in this endeavor here, and then a 0 whenever it fails. And then I do the same thing for state number 2 using a different set of singlets from my original large collection, and for state 3 and for state 4. And then eventually I build up a large table of successes or failures. And all of this has not involved any communication from Alice to Bob. This is just what Alice does. She knows that some of Bob's singlets have been successfully prepared in the states that she wants to send, and some of them at random half have not been prepared. So she just looks through this table and finds a column where they were all successful and tells them the index of the column, which on average requires just asymptotically n bits if she's trying to send n states. So she's sending an unknown state or a known state for 1 bit asymptotically, whereas it would have taken 2 bits to do it by teleportation if she hadn't known the state. And of course, it uses a tremendous amount of entanglement. But we know how to recycle the entanglement, because the only thing Alice cares about is the one successful column. So she doesn't really need to make all these measurements at all. She wants to make an incomplete von Neumann measurement on all of these things that says, did they all succeed, or was it one of the other cases, and I don't care which. And in that case, this is a very non-disturbing measurement that leaves all of these other singlets that are shared with Bob in the unsuccessful columns in a highly entangled pure state from Alice's point of view, but a highly entangled mixed state from Bob's point of view. And using back communication, we don't want to use forward communication because that's what we're trying to economize on, but using back communication, Bob can distill this entanglement to a smaller amount of pure entanglement, and the loss turns out to be only 3.8 bits. E-bits per qubit sent in the limit of large block size. Well, finally, I'm going to say something about... I've spoken about channels and transforming one state to another, but one of the most to a physicist, most reasonable things to think of as a resource is just the interaction between two systems. And of course, an interaction can be used to generate entanglement and communicate and perform gate operations. And so there should be a theory of interaction as a communications resource. And it's probably going to turn out to be one of these complicated resources where it can't be characterized by a single scalar quantity. So the idea here is that if we have two parties, and they what we'd like to simulate an interaction Hamiltonian H acting for a certain period of time, but we don't have H, we have some other Hamiltonian H prime. I mean, this is actually very, very similar to what goes on in NMR experiments. We have the Hamiltonian nature gives us, and we want to simulate another one. And our freedom is that we can turn this other one on and off. Well, that's not quite like NMR. But we can do local, we can turn it on and off, and we can do local operations in Alice's lab and Bob's lab. And the question is, how efficiently can this combination of local operations and the Hamiltonian that we have be used to simulate some other Hamiltonian that we don't have? And I got interested in this question really by being able to think of it as a quantum love story based on the classic tale of Pyramus and Thisbe, which you can read about in Shakespeare, although he was not the originator of it. It's a Greek myth, I think. So we have these two people who are in love, but their parents forbid them to communicate. And they can't visit, and they can't talk, and their parents won't even let them exchange email. But fortunately, they live next door to one another. But unfortunately, there's a wall between their two houses, and fortunately, there's a hole in the wall. And unfortunately, the hole is only big enough for one atom of Alice to interact with one atom of Bob. Fortunately, they know quantum mechanics, and they know that this one-atom interaction is in principle quite powerful. And it actually guarantees a certain kind of privacy, because if they, if some other system is participating in this interaction between A and B, the entangled state of A and B will decohere and become randomized, which they can detect. So they go on, and they realize what they want is to experience the many atom Hamiltonian H, which is pictured here. But they only have this one atom Hamiltonian to do it. So they don't lose hope. They know they can prepare their respective atoms in any initial state, and then take the atom and sort of cook it in proximity to the other atom, take it out again, do some more transformations, replace it by another atom, put it back in the wall. And then they can also use this for classical communication. They can generate entanglement, and they can use these atoms to influence each other just as a way of classically communicating too. So therefore, anything that could be done with shared entanglement and classical communication, they can do also with this Hamiltonian H prime. Of course, this means H prime is not just a sum of separate Alice and Bob terms. It has to be actually an interaction of some sort. And so this means that they can get actually any quantum state of A and B, and this. Therefore, they can go and put themselves in whatever state they want, including what if they had been allowed to be together. And so the moral of the story is the parents should have plugged up the hole in the wall and allowed them unlimited email because they could never become entangled. And indeed, what even they said to each other would have to have been a little bit more careful because they would never know that it was not overheard by an eavesdropper. And so the moral of the story is, if the hole is open, by the time they get to be old lovers, they can experience exactly what it would have been like to be young lovers if they're still foolish enough to want that. So that seems to me like a good place to end also. Thank you.